École normale supérieure, savoir en multimédia.
Nous accueillons le professeur Mark Harrison de l'Université de Warwick, qui est un spécialiste au croisement de trois objets historiques, l'histoire de la Russie soviétique et du bloc soviétique, d'une part, l'histoire des guerres, des questions de défense et de sécurité, et puis, en troisième lieu, une histoire plus particulière, plus difficile aussi, parce qu'elle touche, et il nous en dira tout à l'heure un peu plus, à des problèmes de source, l'histoire du secret, de la dissimulation, de la fraude dans les organisations et dans les relations entre les organisations ou éventuellement les États. Il y a évidemment une rencontre entre ces trois objets dans le cas de l'Union soviétique, qui est un régime qui a eu à se défendre, qui s'est constitué contre les pays qui l'entouraient, qui a donc dû se protéger et pour cela cultiver, particulièrement dans les questions de défense et de sécurité, cultiver le secret et éventuellement plus que le secret. Le secret pour les autres, en quelque sorte, le secret offensif. Alors, le professeur Harrison a de nombreuses publications à son actif. J'ajoute, ce n'est pas la moindre de ses particularités, qu'il est un spécialiste d'histoire économique. Je n'ai pas encore assez souligné que toutes ces questions ont une forte dimension économique et qu'il enseigne, je crois, dans un département d'économie à l'Université de Warwick. Donc, parmi ses travaux, il y a en particulier un ouvrage dont il est le co-éditeur sur les questions économiques durant la Première Guerre mondiale. Donc, vous voyez qu'il couvre une large séquence chronologique qui englobe la Première et la Seconde Guerre mondiale, avec, évidemment, entre les deux, l'histoire de la construction de l'Union soviétique. Alors, je crois qu'un texte qu'il nous a gentiment envoyé a été adressé. Je pense que vous l'avez reçu peut-être tardivement, peut-être pas tous. Non ? Non, peu importe. Je sais que votre capacité à entendre l'anglais va vous permettre de suivre sans problème l'exposé du professeur Harrison. À vous la parole. Et merci.
Merci. It's an honor to be here. Thank you for the invitation. So I'm going to try to make this the most interesting discussion possible of the most boring subject. We'll see how we get on. So something that I'm interested in is how secrecy has contributed to the strength and weakness of the Soviet system. And one way to think about this is to compare political systems in a very simple way. It's clear that in democracies we have costly systems of government. And we can see these costs very clearly when democracies, for example, fail to resolve urgent problems. So America, Europe, European countries today all have major fiscal problems, and democratic politicians are failing to resolve them. And one way of thinking about that failure to resolve these issues is that the costs of negotiation and coming to an agreement are too high to reach agreement. So nothing is done. And this makes many people think that at least one advantage of dictatorship is that dictators can at least make a decision. Now, it can be the right decision or the wrong decision, but it's unhindered by processes. And my research is into the processes of dictatorships. And one of the things that we see when we look deeply is that dictatorships also have very effort-laden, costly processes. The problem is that we don't see them. And we don't see them because they're secret. Okay. So why is there secrecy in such systems? Well, if you look at the Soviet regime, The Soviet regime always had enemies. It had enemies at home. It had enemies abroad. And maintaining secrecy had clear benefits in terms of preserving organization, preserving freedom of action, inhibiting the need to account for decisions, hindering the networking, the horizontal networking among bureaucrats and party officials at the same level, forcing them always to go up and down the hierarchy. Secrecy also helped this system to select and recruit and promote people who were loyal. There are obvious ways in which it did that. For example, if I want to know that you are a loyal agent of my system, one thing I can do is I can trust you with a secret and see what you do with it. Are you careful with it or do you share it? I might say to you, here's a state secret. 2 + 2 = 5. Okay? If I say that to you, and then a day later I hear it from you, I know your type. That is the disloyal type. And of course, secrecy can also frame social choices, because if you deny people access to information, you limit the choices they can make. So these are some of the ways in which you can think of secrecy as having benefits for the people in charge of a dictatorship. Now, I'm not going to say any more about the benefits of secrecy. I'm going to talk about the costs of secrecy. But you can think of the costs and benefits as related in the following way. The reason, we see that secrecy is costly. We see that the people who ran the Soviet system were willing to commit quite substantial resources to maintaining secrecy. Why? Because the benefits that they anticipated must have been at least equal to the cost they paid. So it's a kind of, it lets us think about the lower limit on the benefits of secrecy once we can identify the costs. By the way, I'm happy to be stopped, and I'm happy to have questions at any time. When do we finish, Akela?
At 19.
But okay, that's fine.
We can have half an hour or more to discuss.
I'm happy to discuss as we go along. You don't have to wait till the end. In my department, you're lucky to get 3 minutes. Without a question. Okay. So this paper is about what economists call transaction costs, that is, the costs of doing business. We need to look for them before we can find out how much they are. And of course, it's impossible to look at the transaction costs when they're secret. Right? We have to wait for a regime change. The regime has to change, has to fall, and then we can look at the records of the regime historically in order to identify these things. And you might think to yourselves that secrecy has many dimensions, not just the things that I'll look at today. And secrecy has behavioral costs, because it makes people behave in a different way. And it also has procedural costs, because administering secrecy requires you to follow certain procedures. And I'm very happy to discuss the behavioural costs, but I have a different paper about the behavioural costs. That is, when people are frightened and mistrustful because of secrecy, it changes how they make decisions. Today I'm going to talk about just procedural costs. And what we'll find is that the procedural costs alone are very large. Okay, so... This paper is about a system of accounting for secrets. The research that I've done is done mostly in the Hoover Archive in California. The Hoover Archive has a number of collections from Moscow, and also increasingly from the Baltic republics, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. And these records can be exploited to produce data about the system of accounting for secrets, And what we find is that each secret document had a life course, a beginning and then various stages and then an end. And each of these stages produced data, further documentation, which allow us to estimate what the costs of administering secrecy were. And in case we never get there, the conclusion that I come to is that over a period of around 30 years, which I call Soviet normality, from 1954 to 1982, if you look at the Lithuania KGB archive, around one third of the documentation is documentation that accounts for other documentation. Right? And then you have to make a number of assumptions, which I'll discuss in a bit, that you may think are more or less plausible. But what this tends to suggest is that secret decision-making under Soviet conditions was very costly. Okay, so I'm going to talk a bit about principles. Then I'm going to go on to talk about the life of the secret document. I'm going to talk about measurement. And then that's really it. Okay, so let's think about the principles of Soviet secrecy. So one thing I want to say is that, I mean, I've been studying Soviet history since the 1970s, long before the Cold War ended. You know, the thing that we all knew most was that many things were secret. There was a wall of secrecy that was clearly designed to prevent not only spies and journalists, but also scholars from finding out the truth. And then in 1991, the dictatorship collapsed and secrecy collapsed at the same time. And then I was just very fortunate to be one of a group of historians who went straight into the Soviet archives. And so what we found was that the archives were vast. Until that moment, we didn't know how much they wrote down. And the answer is that they wrote down almost everything. Almost everything was documented. Most documents were classified at some level of secrecy. And in fact, what was published turned out to be the tip of the iceberg. So until then, we might have thought that, of course, there's a certain amount that is published, and then there's a certain amount that they kept secret. And what we discovered was that what they kept secret was far more than what they ever published. And then underlying this mass of secrets was a system, which they called conspiratia. There's probably a French word, which is conspiration or something like that, which I translate. So again, you'll probably have to help me with the French. But in English, there is a word conspiracy, which means a plot. In Russian, it's a zagovor. Right? So it's conspiratia is a broader conceptual idea. It doesn't mean a plot. It means a system of plotting. And this system was codified. It had explicit rules in the system of party and state administration. And it clearly had origins in the organization of the Underground Revolutionary Party before 1917. But once the Underground Revolutionary Party became the party of government, it translated its revolutionary underground system of working into a system of government. And it codified this system in the 1920s. And this quotation here is simply a quotation from the resolution of 1927. The old, well-tried principle that secret matters should be disclosed only to those for whom it is absolutely necessary to know. And it's clear that from the outset, this system of conspiratia, conspirativeness, relied on the absolute loyalty of party members and was a test of that loyalty. Now, sometimes people are curious about the system of censorship. And censorship is a subject in its own right. So censorship is the filter that prevents between government business and the public. And so I don't want to say much about censorship, but if you're curious, what I want to say is that there was also a system of censorship which sat on top, and censorship policies varied a lot over time. So you could think of censorship as being in existence from the start of the Soviet regime, but building up to a peak in the late 1940s when almost no fact could be published, and then diminishing through the rest of Soviet history, so that in the 1960s and 1970s you could know quite a lot. So censorship varied, but what I want to say to you is that the underlying system of handling secrets did not vary at all. It was pretty much constant from the start of the Soviet regime to the end. Okay. So the matters that were covered by state secrecy were defined by law. For example, there were laws in 1947, 1966, that laid down what is a state secret. And they also, these laws also laid down levels of secrecy. So it's a funny thing. Most administrative systems seem to have three levels. The American system has three levels. The British system has three levels. I don't know whether the French system has three levels. Probably. It seems to be something that bureaucrats like. So in the Soviet system, there was secret, top secret, and then the highest level was special file or of special importance. So special files were often known only to handfuls of people. These levels of secrecy were then graded in terms of their significance. So, for example, if you wanted to have a management position in Soviet, in almost any position under the Soviet regime, it didn't matter if you wanted to show films or to run a factory or to distribute food, somewhere you had to deal with secret correspondence. And so anybody in a position of responsibility had to be cleared for access to secret correspondence, and you could have third level, second level, first level of clearance, which gave you access to these various levels of secret documentation. These levels of secrecy also corresponded to importance. So the top two levels were state secrets. This meant that they were secrets of importance to the whole government system, whereas something that was merely secret would be of importance only to a department or an agency or an enterprise. And then there's also the question of the consequences of violation. So to violate a special file or to violate a top secret or to disclose a top secret was a criminal offence. To disclose something that was only secret might be a criminal offence or it might be an administrative offence, depending on the circumstances. So there are clear levels of secrecy, and they have these levels have importance. But they mattered for some things and not others. So they mattered for promotion and selection. So we know that one way of thinking about this system is as a means of social control. That is, if you want to prosper under Soviet conditions, you have to show that you're trustworthy in handling secret correspondence so that with promotion you can gain access to higher and higher levels of secrecy. And that means that you have to conform to Soviet standards of good behavior. It also determined your punishment if you failed. But when we look at the system of accounting for secrets, we find that these levels of classification didn't matter at all. Everything went into the same system, regardless of its level of classification. One way that we can think about the procedures that resulted was as a kind of turnover tax or a transaction tax. That is, each time I send a memorandum to you and you send one back, it has to be registered. I register that I've given it to you. You register that you've received it. If you write back to me, you register, I register, and so on. And this takes time. So it imposes a cost upon doing business. And it's like a tax. It has the same effects as a tax. But of course, it doesn't create a revenue, because the revenue is consumed in the act of collecting the tax, creating the paperwork. The second thing is that this tax has a multiplier. And the reason for the multiplier is that if I send you a memorandum and I register it, what I've registered is the existence of a state secret. I've given you a secret document, and now I've written down that this secret document exists. And what I've written down is also secret. Right? So I've created a secret on top of the one that already existed, and this secret now has to be taken just as much care of as the one I gave to you. So I call this recursive. It's a recursive property of secrecy. That is, the existence of secrets is itself a secret. And so the documentation that accounts for classified documents also has to be accounted for. So we have a system of accounting that has to account for itself, right? And you can see that there's a process of recursion here, which, I mean, you can think of it mathematically if you like. It's infinite. It's not unbounded. There is a limit. So just as mathematical multipliers aren't necessarily infinite, it'll stop at a certain point. And this is an interesting property which we can make use of in trying to measure the costs of this system. Okay. So one thing that one inevitably has to think about is comparisons. And one of the things that I'll also come to is whether it's possible to compare the costs of secrecy under different systems. And so one aspect of my work has also been to look at American secrecy. And it's clear that in both systems, you have a kind of... you have a machine that's very hard to control. It has a logic of its own. The American system has billions of secrets and has many of the same problems as Soviet secrecy. But nonetheless, there are differences. So if you think of the principles, okay, so these are the explicit principles of the two systems. They do look quite different. If you look at the principles of American secrecy, it's clear that running throughout the system is the idea that the citizens should be informed, in principle. When you look at the Soviet system, there's no such acknowledgement ever that the citizens should be informed. In the American system, there's a presumption that ultimately every classified document should be released. Now, ultimately is a slippery word. You can put off the ultimate as long as you like. But nonetheless, there's a presumption in principle that one day secrets should be released. Whereas there's no such presumption in the Soviet system. It's very noticeable if you ever find yourselves in a Soviet archive, the conditions there are very uncomfortable for scholars, because it's clear these archives were built never thinking that independent scholars would enter them to do research. They existed purely to conserve administrative documentation for the leadership in it and for its own purposes. The third thing is whether secrecy is or is not recursive. So if you look at the principles of American secrecy, it's ambiguous. So there's a period between 1953 and 1982, so that's from Truman, from Eisenhower to Reagan, when it was explicitly stated in presidential orders that the existence of a secret is not a secret. Okay, so for those 30 years, which cover most of the Cold War, American secrecy was in principle not recursive. But this phrase then disappeared from later presidential orders and has not been restored. This doesn't mean that American secrecy is recursive to the same extent as Soviet secrecy, but it means there's no prohibition of it. Is American secrecy open to overclassification? Yes, clearly. It's clearly the case that the incentive for every bureaucrat is to classify sometimes unnecessarily, as is the case in the Soviet system. Do American citizens have the right to request declassification? Yes, since 1966, the Freedom of Information Act. Is the scale of classification activity disclosed? Yes, in America, since 1979, when a security oversight office was established, and since then has published annual reports on the scale of classification activity. Only since 2010, under President Obama, have there been targets for declassification. But I think the last thing is American secrecy contested? Yes, all the time. Whereas in the history of the Soviet Union, not only was Soviet secrecy never contested, it was never even discussed. So that's what I wanted to say about principles. Now I'm going to go on to talk about the practice of Soviet secrecy, and I'll talk about the secret document. Okay, so as I said, I'm happy to stop and discuss, but if not, I'll carry on. So you can think of the Soviet secret document going through various stages. It's produced, and the evidence of its production is internal. I'll show you in a moment there's something written on the document. And then it's distributed. And when it's distributed, it's written down. And it's written down in English, it's a ledger or a day book. I guess in French it might be a journal. Journal, okay. So it's the same as the English day book. And it's, a day book is something you write down everything that happens in the order that it happens. Right? And you just start at the first page and you work through to the end. And these ledgers are 200 pages typically, okay? So they're bound volumes, 200 pages, with several items on a page. And so the distribution of secret documents was first of all entered in ledgers. Now, this is what I think of as the first order of recursion of Soviet secrecy, because we've written a secret document, I've sent it to you, and I've written it in my journal. But this journal is a secret because it contains evidence of secrets. Okay? So that completes the first order of the recursion. And then there are second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, 99th orders, but I'll just call them higher orders of recursion, in which these ledgers and the documents that we've distributed enter into subsequent stages. And these stages are inventories, which then result in more documents, for example, deeds or acts of that show inventorization. There's audit reports that discuss the quality of storage and document handling. And then at the end of life, the document is either burned or put in the archive. And that too has to be documented. So that completes the life course of the document. Now, one thing I want to say is, there's a lot of documentation under here. It's, when you look at it, it's the most boring stuff in the world. And I would say that nobody would ever set out to do research on this just by thinking, oh, that's an interesting piece of paper. And indeed, for myself, I just want to share with you that I looked at this stuff for years without understanding what it was. And because I was reading on microfilm, I would look at this stuff and think, I really don't want to know. And I would turn the knob that speeds up the microfilm. And it wasn't until I started thinking, why is there so much of this, that I began to think, maybe this stuff needs more attention. But it's astonishingly tedious stuff. I just want to... Right, okay. So I'll just show you a little bit about these different stages. So to begin with, every document has its own certificate of birth. And so often it's on the bottom corner, it's on the back. And this one just says, so, produced in two copies, the first to the addressee, the second to the file, and there's the file number, There's the person responsible, Baltinus. This is the typist, Kuzina. This is the date, 6th of February 65. And this is from, it's pretty much a random document from the Lithuania KGB archive. And this is a slight, they're all pretty much the same. This is a slight variation. Here, nobody's bothered to fill in the file it's gone to, which is quite common. This one has the additional information. The draft, the handwritten original, has been destroyed. So, you see these with small variations everywhere that documents are produced that have a classification. Okay. So, we move on to distribution, which is the point at which we start to create new documentation. So, the first thing is that every Soviet agency and enterprise, from a weapons factory to a cinema, had its own first department. And the role of the first department was the secret department that had the job of handling secret correspondence. Even the KGB had a first department. The first department was staffed by party members. It was supervised directly by the security agencies. And the first department had these ledgers. So ledgers of incoming and outgoing correspondence and telegrams. And the volume of, the quantity of ledgers could be very large. So just to give an example, in March 53, the Gulag is the chief administration of labor camps. It has a secretariat in Moscow. When the secretariat changed hands, this means that the old boss went out and the new boss came in. Part of the handover was to hand over the documentation, which required an inventory. So we see the inventory of documentation that was on hand at this moment. 343 correspondence ledgers, so that's nearly 70,000 pages, more than half of it secret documentation. And that's just 2 years of correspondence. Okay. Now, distribution involves movement. So far, it's I've just been handing it to you, and we're each writing our ledgers. But you might be 1,000 or 10,000 kilometers away. So then we need a courier, and the courier should either be our own special courier, or we can also use the special service of the Ministry of Communications. And so it seemed like a pretty safe system. Of course, things go wrong all the time. And one of the things that's interesting to look at things that go wrong is that they reveal the system. They reveal the system, and they also reveal incentives. So I'm an economist, I'm interested in incentives. When we look at carelessness, we see that people were not motivated to take the proper care. And what we see is that actually things went wrong all the time. So you can imagine to yourselves, you're sitting in an office in Omsk, right? And the courier arrives. Secret packet for you. You sign for it. You open it, and your heart sinks. Because what you signed for is not in the packet. Right? There's a page missing, or the document might have the wrong number, but you've signed for it, so it's your fault. And one of the principles of the system is that at any moment, someone is responsible. So what do you do? Okay, so you immediately call together a committee, and this committee has five colonels, or majors, you know, military. Everybody has a military rank in the system, and you sign an affidavit, an act, a legal document about the discrepancy, right? And you send the discrepancy back. You send the document back, by the way, generating more entries in ledgers. Okay, and you also file it. And because you've signed this legal document, you're safe. Okay. Lots of things like that could happen. It might be my fault. It might be your fault. Sometimes the person receiving the document didn't give a receipt. And then there's something has gone astray. Very often, the courier was at fault, because the courier has to travel 5,000 kilometers from Moscow to Omsk. You're traveling on a train. It's boring. So what do you do when you're on a train and you're bored? You drink, right? Somewhere along the way, your briefcase is stolen. It's astonishing the number of stolen briefcases in these archives. And it's usually associated with alcohol. Okay, so the document has been written, produced, and distributed, but then it sits there. And while it sits there, it'll be inventorized. So in many offices there was a regular monthly stock taking. So the documents that are in our files have to be counted against the documents in the ledgers. The ledgers show what's come in. So what's come in should be in the file. So we have to compare the numbers coming in and the numbers in the files. There are many of these inventories in the archives. Usually they show a perfect match. But what's interesting is that these documents are always signed off by several people. It's never one person's signature. So it's not enough for me just to say, yes, my office is perfect. I have to get my colleague to sign off on it as well. And then my colleague knows that he's responsible too. So you can imagine that it was possibly sometimes quite hard to get everybody to agree that it was perfect. So if everybody signs that it's perfect, it has some meaning. As I said, when offices change hands, everybody has to sign. The outgoing officer signs, the incoming officer signs. And the incoming officer has a strong incentive not to sign if there's something missing. Because if the incoming officer signs off on a missing document, then the incoming officer is responsible. And these transfers did occasionally show losses. And when losses materialized, they were always reported straight away to a rather high level. So I'm going to show you some examples now. So this is the a handover of a Gulag secretariat in 1953. So this is just to show you... Well, I'm afraid the title's too small. You can't really see. The day books of incoming post, 1951-64. Secret, non-secret 63, and so on. So this is how you get to the total I gave you a few minutes ago, 300 and something for 2 years. On this side is a document that which is addressed to the Interior Minister, to Comrade Krugloff, and the date is 1948. And what it's saying is that on the previous occasion of the handover of this office, a missing document materialised. A document proved to be missing. It was traced to the former head of the Gulag, who said that he'd taken this decree away to work with, and he didn't know where it was. So that's reported back to the new chief of Gulag, and then to the Interior Minister. And the Interior Minister's comment is, it's written down here, the minister has asked that you look again. Right? This is a serious matter. We don't just accept the report and leave it. So this is from a later period, from the 60s. This is the handover of the first department of the second administration. So the second administration is the counterintelligence administration of the Lithuania KGB. And these are all the documents. So this document goes on for pages. Listing all the documents on hand. There are hundreds of them. And the largest single component is these. These are the ledgers. Account for about half of the total documentation that is being handed over from one officer to the other. So the type's small, and so I won't... take up much of your time with that. The others are all just different kinds of documentation, ordinary files, arrest warrants, information about German intelligence, lists of war criminals, this kind of stuff. Okay. So, this slide just deals with the last part of the secret documents live course. So documents had to be stored, and they had to be stored in facilities that were secure, and often you get reports of inadequate facilities, for example, safes that don't lock, rooms that are not sealed. So if I'm running our first department properly, at night, I lock all the filing cabinets and seal them with wax. Then I leave the room and I put a seal on the door. And this, but often the facilities weren't sufficient to ensure that. And then there's human frailty. People are human, they don't always go by the rule book. And so what you find is that a moment ago I said to you there's a lot of evidence of everything working well, lots of perfect inventories. But there's also occasional scandals, audits that show that a particular office, bad habits have taken hold and have spread from one desk to another. And so secret documents are left out at night, they're not properly accounted for, they're even taken home. The most famous of these came in 1949 when there was an investigation of secret document mishandling in Gosplan, the State Planning Commission. And the target of this investigation was Nikolai Voznesensky, who was previously Stalin's favorite. And his rivals, Malenkov and Beria, were organizing an intrigue that caused Stalin to lose faith in Voznesensky. But this intrigue was not without foundation, and it seems that in Gosplan, everybody had bad habits. Finally, there's destruction. So at the end of its life, the document must be either incinerated, burned, or sent to the archive. And more documents reveal this. Sometimes they're very short. It just says, today we burned 1,000 documents. Sometimes they list every document, page after page after page. And you can think that this is an important moment, partly because it provides the opportunity to cover mistakes. If there are missing documents, now is the time that you report them as burned. There's only one thing that can go wrong. What if the document you say you've burned later turns up? Perhaps at home, right? And this actually happened in the Gosplan affair. Documents that were reported as incinerated turned up in somebody's private library. Okay. Yeah.
What are the criteria as to decide whether the document is burned or archived?
So it's frequently written, we, the undersigned, burned these documents after determining that they were neither of operational nor historical value. Okay. So the criterion was no operational value and no historical value. Now, it's impossible to tell what that really means because we don't have the documents they burned. All we have is the documents they left.
Mm. Right? You assume that they actually burned the document that were less important.
It's a very important question, and before I finish, I'll talk about this in more detail because there are some very strange things in these archives. Okay? So be patient. Okay. Right. Okay. So a few minutes ago I said you could think of this as this set of procedures like a tax. And if we look at taxation, we should look for compliance, we should look for avoidance, which is legal, and we should look for evasion, which is illegal. There's lots and lots of evidence of compliance. There's almost no evidence of avoidance, which in some ways is surprising. They have this costly, burdensome system, and yet it's very hard to find anybody ever saying we should make fewer secret documents. That's what I mean by avoidance. If you're facing a tax bill, you think, how can I create less taxable income? Or how can I report more costs? In this case, you want to think of people saying, well, how can we try to economize on secret documentation? There is a very small number of documents that do show this. And when they do, they say, we must urge everybody to be more careful. Like they never propose concrete steps. So that's what I mean when I say there's almost no evidence of avoidance. There is evidence of evasion, and the evidence is chiefly in these local scandals that appear from time to time in particular agencies. And as an economist, I think, well, how can we reconcile these? And one way that the economist would think of this is to say, well, perhaps this is a system in which there are two equilibria. There's a good equilibrium and a bad equilibrium. So in the good equilibrium, everybody is loyal, everybody is obedient, everybody complies perfectly. And, you know, if I join an office in which that happens, I think to myself, I must be really careful. You know, if I'm not, I'll stand out. So I need to be like everybody else. But there's also clearly a bad equilibrium in which people don't really care about the rules. They just want to get the job done. They leave documents out on desks, or they do whatever is easiest. And if I join that office, I look around and I say, okay, I know what the rules say, but what I see is that you're, being sensible, right? You're just, doing what has to be done to get the job done, and I'll do like you. So you can think of both of these equilibria as sustainable. You can also think that there could be a tendency to slip from the good equilibrium to the bad equilibrium, because over time people maybe become less strictly compliant with the rules, and then habits start to slip and they spread from desk to desk, until some super fundamentalist comes along and says, this is a scandal, I'm going to report you, I'm going to make trouble for you, and I don't care what you think of me, this is how fundamentalists are, right? And the fundamentalist provokes a scandal that frightens everybody, and then everybody resolves to behave better in the future. So that's how I picture it, but that's just an intuition. It's hard to know how to verify that sort of story. It's just a story that is roughly consistent with what we see. So now I'm going to talk about measurement. So are we okay? So okay. So we're dealing. I'm going to talk about the Lithuania KGB collection at Hoover. The total collection is around 1 million pages, 5,000 files. But I'm going to not consider about 1/3 of this collection, because, roughly speaking, you can think of it as 1/3 personal files or case files. These are records of particular investigations or particular people whom the KGB was watching from the 1920s, right? Long before Lithuania was part of the Soviet Union. There's a story that my colleague Amir Viner tells about. It's actually from the memoirs of Menachem Begin, who fell into the hands of the KGB in 1940. And they were very interested in his activities in the 1930s. And he said, but in the 1930s, Lithuania was an independent state. What I was doing was not illegal. And his interrogator said, listen, Article 58, this is the article of the Russian Federation Penal Code that deals with counter-revolutionary activities, Article 58 is for all people at all times. If you don't come to us, we'll come to you. So even in the 20s, they were watching Lithuania and gathering this kind of information. Yes, so here we are. These files begin in 1926. So these files, I don't consider. These files are open for decades. I'm interested in everything else. These are what I call the management files. These are the day-to-day files about the running of the KGB. Okay. And so the next thing, we can plot these files over time. And if you just focus on forget about the detail, just look at the outer part of this. It's very strange. And demands some kind of explanation. So this is 1944, 1953, 1985. Some of this is very puzzling, but some of it is easily explained. So for a start, we can just divide this into periods. Until 1953 or 54, Lithuania was essentially in a state of civil conflict. It was under military occupation. There was an insurgency going on. And most of what the KGB was doing was counterinsurgency. Then there's a period of normality, and then from 1985 onwards, the Soviet system is going through huge changes again. And I'm going to focus on this period, and this is the period in which I'm going to tell you that at least one third of all the archived documentation of the KGB is accounting for secrets. So just to give you an idea of how it works, this is a unique data source because we have a very good file-by-file description that was created when the files were microfilmed in Vilnius for transmission to the Hoover Institution in California. And of course, there are other sorts of published file catalogs from Soviet archives, but they're never as detailed as this. And it's the detail here that enables us to work out what's going on. So this is just an excerpt. And one of the interesting things is the first three items here are acti, that means deeds, they're legal documents of the receipt and transfer and destruction of documents. So this is exactly what I mean by files that document what has happened to other documents. And then this is about communications and reports of the KGB about partisan and other anti-Soviet manifestations in the struggle with the Lithuanian Nationalist Underground, reports, communications of the Fourth Administration, blah, 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 about the distribution of anonymous anti-Soviet documents and the process of establishing their authorship. And so what I do is I take what's in this middle section here, and there are around 3,500 files. This central column has around 86,000 words, from which I create 1,400 unique keywords, and just out of interest, I put them under three categories, which I call operational, so these are mission-oriented, organizational, so these are about the organization of the Soviet state, and then procedural, which is where the stuff that I'm interested in is in. Okay. And I assign these files to various categories, so there's a lot of discussion in the paper. Essentially, I'm looking for clusters of keywords that will show up the purpose of the documentation. And so I don't really want to discuss this at any length now, but I'm happy to answer questions about it. But this is probably the most tedious part of the whole thing. So, but like I said, I can get interested in it and excited if you want to ask me questions. Okay. And then, just out of interest, here are the 25 most popular keywords from the whole archive. And here's operational, organizational, procedural. So right at the top we find partisans, struggle, anti-Soviet, underground, nationalist, verification, this is a Lithuanian nationalist organization, foreigners, authors, organizational, so you've got lots of initials here, agencies of the Soviet state, workers, administrations, rural districts, agent network, and so on. And then procedural, document report, reference report, file, list, and so on. So these are the sort of things I guess you'd expect to find. But this is what we think of the KGB is doing. This is its mission. This is how it organizes itself. And these are the procedures that it follows in order to organize itself. And then, here's numbers 11 to 25. It's not completely straightforward. Russian is a language that declines and conjugates, so you have to lose the end of each word to find unique stems. One of the interesting ambiguities I found was, I began by taking the first five letters of each word, and one such word would be anti-s, right? And anti-s, it turned out, is not unambiguous. It could be anti-sovietsky, anti-Soviet, or it could be anti-Semitichesky. And in the whole data set, I think anti-Sovietsky has, I'm not sure I've got this here, about 900 occurrences, anti-Semitichesky, one. Okay, so that's just some of the results that come up along the way. So here's the main thing. So this is just to summarize. We've got one thing I'm going to show you is the explanation for that huge mountain of files at the beginning. And it's very simple to explain. So here we have the column that has all the documents. This is the early period. Remember, this is the 1954 to 82 is the period I'm most interested in, and then the final period. And we have in the early period 2,000 files, 142 a year. It's a huge, massive documentation. And half the entire archive is to do with the with counterinsurgency. So it's mostly files created in the early period. Files continue to be created later because it's now backward-looking. Once Lithuania is at peace and quiet, we're still interested in who was engaged in the insurgency, who are the insurgents, what are they doing now, do we need to watch them? So it's backward-looking. But you can also see, here's a quarter of the documentation is accounting for secrets. It's documents accounting for other documents. And then you can also see the other things that the KGB was doing. So if you think of the KGB, I don't know about you, but I think of the KGB, well, it was harassing dissidents and pursuing nationalists and tapping telephones and opening letters and so on. That's all here, after counterinsurgency and after accounting for secrets. You can also see something about what's happening over time. So I'm getting tired of stretching. So let's just... Okay, so you can see there the explanation for that huge mountain of documentation in the early period. It's all to do with counterinsurgency. And you can also see that in this early period, relatively little documentation was devoted to accounting for secrets. But here's the figure for the period of Soviet normality. Between 1954 and 82, one-third of this archive is documents that account for other documents. Okay. So, and then a strange thing happens in the last period, 1983 to 91. So this figure here is huge. And of course, I showed you that spike. And the last part, I'll show you the diagram again in a minute, just to remind you. But this is interesting, and it's something that demands explanation. And then the rest of the... table is here. And so if you think of what the KGB was doing in peacetime, in normal times, police work... 20% of the the police work means looking for people and finding them. Okay, complaints and petitions, economic matters, anonymous circulars. But none of these is as important as this 34% of the archive that is documentation about documentation. So here's the chart again. So now we can see. All this is to do with the counterinsurgency. There's something that happens here in the year that Stalin dies that produces a lot of documentation, but it's not clear, you know, looking at the documentation itself, why that should be. They just kept a lot of documents from that year or something, we don't know. And then this is interesting because you can see that all of this spike is ledgers. Okay, let me show you this more clearly. This is just the documentation of accounting for secrets, and it divides it into higher order and first order. So in most years, there's just one or two ledgers that are kept. See, they're kept. The rest are burned. And then for some reason in 85, they didn't throw them away. They kept them all. And it's a mountain. Right? There's a huge amount of them. And that prompts an interesting thought, which is, what if all the ledges from previous years were being disproportionately destroyed? Every year they were throwing them all out, except for a couple that they kept just for history. Maybe that figure of 34% is an underestimate of the documentation that was accounting for secrets. Okay, so the last thing I want to talk about is 34% a lot? You know, what standards of comparison should we have? So this is the most difficult part of the entire project, because we're asking questions here that people don't normally ask. And it, you know, indeed, I mean, I've shown this diagram to people who spend half their lives working with these archives, and they have no idea of what's in their own archive. So these are questions that people haven't asked before, and I have very little idea whether I'm going to answer this to your satisfaction or even to mine. But I have two benchmarks, and the first one is just something that came from a newspaper article. So, and it comes from a costing the activity of the Metropolitan Police. They don't do this anymore because policemen don't like filling in forms, right? So, but in 2005-06, we have this report that the Metropolitan Police in London spent around 5% of its budget on non-incident-linked paperwork and on checking paperwork. And when that figure came out, it made newspaper headlines. So that makes me think, well, the public thinks that to spend 5% of your budget on secrecy is a lot. Then there's a second benchmark, which is perhaps a little bit closer to what we're looking for. So as I said to you a little while ago, the Americans now publish data on the annual data on the volume of classification activity. And since around 2002 or 3, they publish annual reports on the cost of classification activity. So we have official figures about the costs of secrecy to American government. The question really is, what should you compare that figure to get the right fraction? So this bullet point tells you $6 billion. Now, these are information security costs, so they're not physical security, they're not the security of facilities. I'm trying to leave out expenditures on declassification, education, training, operation security, and so on. So it seems like about the right sort of concept for $6 billion. There are three departments that made 95% of this $6 billion. So in this fraction here, we're going to have 95% of six. The question is, what should go here? So what I take is defense, state, and justice, they're personnel costs. These are three, well, they're a very different size. I guess defense is the biggest. But federal outlays on wages and salaries, so it's not including things like operations, maintenance, procurement, research, construction, and housing. $185 billion. And that gives you a fraction of around 3%. Is that right? I'm not really sure, but it's the best I've done so far. So, we have this figure of a third for the documentation of accounting for secrecy in this Lithuania KGB archive. On the two benchmarks that I've shown you, one third is a lot. It's greater by an order of magnitude. Is this figure of one third something you can generalize? If the KGB spent a third of its time checking its own paperwork, would the same be true of other Soviet agencies? Well, this is what we need to think about now. So it would be good if the KGB was not markedly more secret than any other Soviet organization. That seems like a strong assumption. I'm not sure that I would want to make that assumption. Another is that we're making implicit assumptions about paperwork intensity. If you think of different activities, we're assuming that they're all equally intensive in paperwork, including the activity of tracking paperwork. That's paperwork intensive too, to the same extent. That I don't know how to evaluate that assumption. It might be true, it might not. It's a useful assumption if it helps us to get to an answer, but whether it's a valid one, I really don't know. Then the last one is about representativeness. So this is back to your question. Are the documents that we see in the archives representative of the different activities of the KGB? And that seems to me possibly a weak assumption, because it's quite possible that they threw away the documentation of the system of accounting with secrecy with higher readiness than documentation of other activities. So the conclusions are that if you want to understand the transaction costs of dictatorship, you need to look at the transactions that happen behind closed doors, which are secret. So that's a problem, unless you're a historian. And I like being a historian because we can look at the past. And sometimes in the past, we can find answers to these questions. A particular aspect of the Soviet system of secrecy was its recursiveness. We have a system of accounting with secrets that was itself secret and had to account for itself. We have secrecy procedures that seem like they operate as a tax. A tax that continually makes transactions more costly and slows them up. It seems like most of the time, Soviet officials were fairly obedient or compliant. They did what they were supposed to do. But sometimes things went wrong. In a localized way, offices could go bad. They could get bad habits could spread, people could get careless, negligent, and this would go on until somebody stepped in and stopped them. So we have this idea that accounting for secrets made up around one third of the normal archive documentation of the Lithuania KGB. And you could think of this maybe as signaling priorities. It's fairly clear. The first priority of the KGB was to prevent the armed overthrow of the Soviet state. Nothing was more important than that. But if the Soviet state was not militarily threatened, the next priority was protecting its own paperwork. And everything else that we think of as the KGB normally doing, surveillance, harassment, interception of the post and so on, all of those things came after. Okay.
Thank you very much.